Chapter 139. That neither merits nor sins are equal. It is clear from what has been said that neither all good deeds, nor all sins, are equal, for a counsel is only about a greater good. Counsels in the divine law are about poverty, continence and the like, as stated above. Hence these things are better than the use of marriage, and the possession of earthly goods, and yet with these one may live a virtuous life, if one keep within the bounds of reason, as we have proved. Therefore acts of virtue are not all equal. Again, acts take their species from their objects. Therefore the better the object, the more virtuous too will the act be in its species. Now, the end is better than the things directed to the end, and of these one is better than another, the nearer it is to the end. Consequently, the best of human acts is that one which is directed to the last end, namely God, immediately. After this, the act will be so much the better in its species, according as its object is nearer to God. Besides, in human acts the good depends on their being regulated by reason. Now, it happens that some acts are more akin to the reason than others, forasmuch as acts of the reason itself have a greater share in reason's good than the acts of the lower powers, which reason commands. Therefore some human acts are better than others. Also, the precepts of the law are best fulfilled through love, as stated above. Now a man may happen to fulfill an obligation through greater love than another man does. Hence one virtuous act will be better than another. Further, if a man's actions are made good by virtue, and since the same virtue is more intense in one than in another, it follows that one human act is better than another. Moreover, if human acts are made good by virtues, the better act must needs be that which proceeds from the better virtue. Now we see that one virtue is better than another, as magnificence than liberality, and magnanimity than moderation. Thus one human act will be better than another. Hence it is said, he that giveth his virgin in marriage doth well, and he that giveth her not doth better. The same reasons show that all sins are not equal, since by one sin a man strays more from his end than by another, and the order of reason is more subverted and a greater harm done to one's neighbor. Hence it is said, thou hast done more wicked things than they in all thy ways. Hereby we refute the error of those who say that all merits and sins are equal. However, there seem to be some reason for saying that all virtuous acts are equal, because every act is virtuous that tends to the end of the good. Hence, if all good actions have the same good as their end, they must all be equally good. But, though there is one last end of the good, the acts which derive their goodness from it receive various degrees of goodness, because there is a difference of degrees in the goods that are directed to the last end, forasmuch as some are better than others, and approach nearer to the last end. Hence both in the will and in its acts there will be degrees of goodness, according to the diversity of goods that are the term to which the will and its acts are directed, although the last end is the same. In like manner, there would seem to be reason for asserting that all sins are equal, because in human acts sin results only through someone transgressing the rule of reason. Now, one transgresses the rule of reason by deviating therefrom slightly, just as by doing so greatly. Seemingly, then, the sin is equal, whether one sin in small or in great things. This argument is, apparently, confirmed by the practice in human judgment. For if a person is forbidden to go beyond a certain limit, it makes no difference to the judge whether he goes beyond it little or much. Thus it matters not, as soon as the boxer goes outside the ring, whether he go yet further. Therefore from the moment that one transgresses the rule of reason, it matters not whether one transgress little or much. Yet, if we consider the matter carefully, wherever perfection and good consist in a certain balance, the greater the deviation from the requisite balance, the greater the evil. Thus, health consists in a proper balance of the humors, beauty in due symmetry of members, truth in equation between thought or word and thing. And it is clear that the greater the disproportion in the humors, the greater the disease, and the greater the lack of symmetry in the members, the more unsightly the deformity, and the greater the deviation from the truth, the greater the falsehood. For there is not so much falsity in thinking 3 to be 5. As in thinking it to be 100. Now, the virtuous good consists in a certain proportion, for it is the mean, according to the due modification of circumstances, set between contrary vices. Consequently, the greater the divergence from this harmony, the greater the malice. There is no comparison between transgressing a virtue and transgressing the bounds appointed by a judge. Because virtue is a good in itself, wherefore transgression of a virtue is an evil in itself, and consequently a greater deviation from virtue is a greater evil. But to break the particular bounds appointed by a judge is not an evil in itself, but accidentally, because, to wit, it is forbidden. Now, when one thing is predicated accidentally of another, it does not follow of necessity, if A be predicated of B simply, that more A should be predicated of more B, but only when the predication is per se. For it does not follow, if a white being is a musical being, that what is more white is more musical, whereas it does follow, if white dazzles the sight, that more white dazzles the sight yet more. There is, however, this difference to be observed among sins, that some are mortal, and some venial. Mortal sin is that which deprives the soul of spiritual life. What this life consists in may be gathered from two things, by comparing it with natural life. For the body lives naturally through being united to the soul, which is the principle of its life, and the body, quickened by the soul, is moved of itself, whereas a dead body either remains without movement, or is moved only by an extrinsic cause. So too, the human will is not only alive when, by its right intention, it is united to its last end, which union is its subject and, as it were, its form, but also is moved by an intrinsic principle to do what is right when by love man adheres to God and his neighbor. But without the intention of the last end and without love, the soul is dead, as it were, since it is not moved of itself to do what is right, but either leaves off so doing altogether, or is only instigated to do so by some extrinsic principle, namely the fear of punishment. Therefore, all sins that are opposed to the intention of the last end, and to love, are mortal. On the other hand, if a man, without detriment to these, fails in a particular right order of the reason, it will not be a mortal, but a venial sin. Chapter 140. That man's actions are punished or rewarded by God. It is clear from the foregoing that man's actions are punished or rewarded by God, because to punish or reward belongs to him who imposes the law, since legislators induce men to obey the law by rewards and punishments. Now, as we have shown above, it belongs to divine providence to set a law for men. Therefore, it belongs to God to punish or reward men. Again, wherever a certain order is requisite to an end, that order must needs lead to that end, and infringement of that order debars from it, since those things that are on account of the end take their necessity from the end, so that, to wit, they are necessary, if the end has to follow, and, given them, if there be no obstacle, the end will follow. Now, God appointed to man's actions a certain order in relation to the end of the good, as we have already proved. Given that this order is rightly followed, those who comply with it attain the end of good, which consists in being rewarded, while those who forsake that order through sin are debarred from the end of good, which is to be punished. Also, as natural things are subject to the order of divine providence, so to are human acts, as we have shown. In either case, the due order may happen to be observed or disregarded, but there is this difference, that observance or disregard of the due order is left in the power of the human will, whereas it is not in the power of natural things to deflect from the right order, or to follow it. Now, between effect and cause there should be a certain fitting correspondence. Wherefore, as when the requisite order of natural principles and actions obtains in natural things, the result is that, of necessity, their nature is sustained, and their good ensured, whereas corruption and evil result in them, when the natural and requisite order is not observed, so too in human affairs it must needs be that, when man voluntarily keeps the order of the law imposed by God, a good accrues to him, not of necessity as it were, but by the appointment of his Lord, and this is to be rewarded, and conversely, that his lot is evil, when the order of the law has been infringed, and this is to be punished. Besides, it belongs to God's goodness that he leaves nothing out of order. Hence we may observe in natural things that every evil is contained in the order of some good. Thus corruption of the air is generation of fire, and the slaying of the sheep is the meal of the wolf. Since, then, human acts are subject to divine providence, even as natural things are, it follows that whatever evil occurs in human actions must be included in the order of some good. This is most fittingly done in the punishment of sins. For thus things that exceed in due quantity are included in the order of justice, which reduces them to equality. Now, man exceeds the mark of his right quantity, when he prefers his own will to God's, by gratifying it against the divine ordinance. And this inequality is removed when, against his will, man is compelled to suffer something according to the divine ordinance. Therefore man's sins need to be punished by God, and for the same reason his good deeds should be rewarded. Further, divine providence not only appoints the order of things, but also moves all things to the execution of the order by himself appointed, as we have already proved. 658. Now, the will is moved by its object, which is either good or evil. Hence it belongs to divine providence to set good things before man as his reward, that his will may be moved to proceed aright, and to set evil things before him as his punishment, that he may avoid falling out of order. Moreover, divine providence has ordered things in such wise that one is of profit to another. Now, it is most fitting that a man should advance to the end of good, both through the good and through the evil of another man, in that he is urged to do well through seeing that well-doers are rewarded, and is recalled from evil-doing through seeing that evil-doers are punished. Therefore it belongs to divine providence that the wicked be punished, and the good rewarded. This is what is said: I am thy God visiting the iniquities of the fathers upon the children and showing mercy to them that love me and keep my commandments. Also in the psalm, thou wilt render to every man according to his works. Again, who will render to every man according to his works? To them indeed who, according to patience in good work, glory and honor, but to them that, obey not the truth, but give credit to iniquity, wrath and indignation. Hereby we refute the error of some who said that God punishes not, for Marcion and Valentine said that the God who is good is another from the God who is just, and punishes. Chapter 141. Of the difference and order of punishments. Since, then, as we have shown, a reward is something proposed to the will, as an end whereby it is urged to do well, and on the other hand punishment, as an evil to be avoided, is set before the will, to withdraw it from evil, just as it is essential to a reward that it be a good in harmony with the will, so is it a necessary condition of punishment, that it be an evil, and in opposition to the will. Now, evil is the privation of good. Consequently, the difference and order of punishments must be in keeping with the difference and order of goods. Now, the sovereign good is man's beatitude, which is his last end, and the nearer a thing approaches to this end, the higher must it be placed as a good of man. The nearest thing to that end is virtue. Everything else that is of use to man in well-doing, whereby he attains to beatitude. After this comes the right disposition of reason, and of the powers subject thereto. And after this the well-being of the body, which is requisite for facility of action. Lastly come those things that are without, which we employ as helps to virtue. Accordingly man's greatest punishment will be his exclusion from beatitude. After this, privation of virtue, and of any perfection of the soul's natural powers, that conduces to well-doing. Then, disorder in the natural powers of the soul. Then, injury to the body. Lastly, loss of external goods. But as it is a necessary condition of punishment to be not only the privation of a good, but also opposed to the will, and as not every man's will appreciates goods at their true value, it happens sometimes that the privation of a greater good is less opposed to the will, and for this reason seems to be less penal. Hence it is that many people who esteem higher and no better sensible and bodily goods than intellectual and spiritual goods, fear corporal punishment more than spiritual. And in the estimation of such men the order of punishments is apparently the reverse to that given above. For to these, Injuries to the body and loss of external goods seem the greatest punishment, while they think little or nothing of the disorder of their soul, the decay of virtue, and the loss of the divine fruition, wherein man's ultimate beatitude consists. Hence it is that they think that God punishes not the sins of man, because they see that sinners for the most part are sound of body, and outwardly prosperous, while virtuous men sometimes are none of these things. But this should not be a matter of surprise to anyone who considers the matter aright. For since external goods are directed to internal, and the body to the soul, external and bodily goods are so far good for man, as they are conducive to the good as appointed by reason, while, in so far as they stand in the way of reason's good, they become, for man, evil. Now God, the disposer of things, knows the measure of human power. Wherefore at times he apportions bodily and external goods to a virtuous man as a help to virtue, and in this he bestows a favor on him. But sometimes he withdraws those things from him, because he sees them to be a hindrance to virtue and to his enjoyment of God, since for this reason external goods become evil for man, as we have stated, so that, for the same reason, their loss becomes a good for man. If, then, every punishment is an evil, and if it is not an evil for man to be deprived of external and bodily goods, according as this is expedient for his advance in virtue, it will be no punishment for a virtuous man if he be deprived of external goods, to the profit of virtue. On the other hand, for the wicked it will be a punishment if they be granted external goods whereby they are incited to evil doing. Hence it is said that the creatures of God are turned to an abomination, and a temptation to the souls of men, and a snare to the feet of the unwise. Since, however, it belongs to punishment not only to be an evil, but to be opposed to the will, the loss of bodily and external goods, even when it profits man unto virtue, and is not an evil for him, is called a punishment, by a misuse of the term, because it is opposed to the will. The result of man being out of order is that he does not appreciate things at their true value, and prefers the things of the body to those of the soul. This disorder is either sinful, or arises from a preceding sin. Hence it is clear that punishment is not in man, even as contrary to the will, without some preceding fault. Another reason proves this, because things good in themselves would not become evil for men by their abuse, unless some disorder already existed in man. Again, that man needs to be deprived, for the good of virtue, of what the will accepts because it is naturally good, arises from some disorder in man, which is either a sin, or results from sin. For it is evident that the preceding sin produces a certain disorder in man's affective faculty, so that he is afterwards more easily inclined to sin. Therefore, we must suppose some sin in man if he needs to be assisted towards the good of virtue, by means of something, in a sense, penal to him, inasmuch as it is contrary to his will, although sometimes it is voluntary, inasmuch as his reason looks to the end. However, we shall speak further on, of this disorder that affects human nature on account of original sin. But for the present be it clearly understood that God punishes men for their sins, and that he punishes not unless there be a fault. Chapter 142. That punishments and rewards are not all equal. Since then divine justice demands that, for the maintenance of equality among things, punishments be dealt for sins, and rewards for good deeds, it follows that if, as we have shown, there are degrees in acts of virtue and in sins, there must also be degrees in rewards and punishments. For, otherwise, equality would not be observed, if he that sins more received not greater punishment, or he that performs better deeds received not a greater reward, because, in requiting, there is the same reason, apparently, for discriminating between good and bad, as between good and better, or between bad and worse. Moreover, the equality of distributive justice consists in giving unequal things to those who are unequal among themselves. Consequently, the requital by punishments and rewards would not be just, were all rewards and punishments equal. Again, rewards and punishments are appointed by the lawgiver, that men may be drawn away from evil to good, as proved above. Now, not only do men need to be drawn to good things, and withdrawn from evil, but also good men need to be enticed to better, and wicked men withdrawn from worse things. But this would not be the case, were rewards and punishments equal. Therefore both punishments and rewards should be unequal. Further, as a thing is disposed to its form by its natural dispositions, so is a man disposed to punishments and rewards by good and evil deeds. Now, the order which divine providence has established in things is such that things which are more disposed receive a more perfect form. Therefore, there must needs be a difference in punishments and rewards corresponding to the difference of good and evil deeds. Besides, excess occurs in good and evil deeds in two ways. First, in point of number, through one man doing more good or evil deeds than another. Secondly, in point of the quality of the deed, through one man performing a better or a worse deed than another. Now, there ought to be an excess of rewards or punishments corresponding to the excess in number of deeds, else recompense would not be made in the divine judgment for all a man's deeds, if some evil deeds were left unpunished, and some good deeds unrewarded. Equally, therefore, inequality in rewards and punishments corresponds to excess in regard to inequality of deeds. Hence it is said, according to the measure of the sin, shall the measure also of the stripes be, and in measure against measure, when it shall be cast off, I shall punish it. Hereby we refute the error of some who say that, in the life to come, all rewards and punishments are equal. Chapter 143. Of the punishment due to mortal and venial sin in relation to the last end. It is clear from what has been said, that sin may happen in two ways. In one way, so that the intention of the mind altogether breaks away from its order to God, who is the last end of the good, and this is mortal sin. In another way, so that, without prejudice to the human mind's order to its last end, some obstacle is placed, whereby it is hampered in tending freely to its end, and this is called venial sin. If, then, punishments must differ according to the difference of sins, it follows that he who sins mortally should be punished so as to forfeit man's end, but that he who sins venially should be punished not to the extent of forfeiting it, but so as to be hampered, or experience difficulty, in obtaining the end. For thus is the equality of justice maintained, so that in the same way that man by sinning voluntarily turns aside from his end, so by way of punishment, against his will, should he be hindered in the attainment of his end. Again, the will in man corresponds to the natural inclination in natural things. Now, if a natural thing be deprived of its natural inclination to its end, it is quite unable to reach that end. Thus a heavy body, if it lose its weight by corruption, and becomes light, will never reach the center. Whereas if it be hindered in its movement, while retaining its inclination to the end, it will reach its end, when the obstacle is removed. When a man sins mortally, the intention of his will is altogether turned away from his last end, whereas, when he sins venially, his intention remains turned towards his end, yet somewhat hampered, by reason of his adhering more than he ought to those things that are directed to the end. Consequently, the punishment due to one who sins mortally is that he be altogether debarred from obtaining his end, while the punishment due to one who sins venially is that he experience difficulty before attaining his end. Moreover, when a man gets a good thing unintentionally, this is by luck and chance. If, then, a man whose intention is turned away from his last end obtains that last end, it will be by luck and chance. But this is unreasonable, because the last end is a good of the intelligence, whereas luck is incompatible with intelligence, since things that happen by chance occur without the bidding of the intellect, and it is unreasonable that the intellect obtain its end otherwise than in an intelligent way. Therefore a man who, by sinning mortally, has his intention turned away from his last end, will not obtain his last end. Again, matter does not receive a form from the agent unless it be disposed to that form. Now the end and the good are the perfection of the will, as form is of matter. Consequently the will does not obtain the last end unless it be fittingly disposed, but the will is disposed to the end by intending and desiring the end. Therefore a man will not obtain his end if his intentions be averted from the end. Moreover, in things ordained to an end, we find that if the end is or will be obtained, We must of necessity presuppose the things required for obtaining it, and if those things be not granted, neither will the end be obtained, for if the end can be obtained without the things directed to the end, it is useless to seek the end by such means. Now, all are agreed that man obtains his last end, which is beatitude, by deeds of virtue, the chief of which is the intention of the right end. Therefore, if a man act against virtue, through turning away from the intention of the last end, it is fitting that he be deprived of his last end. Hence it is said, "Depart from me, all you that work iniquity." Chapter 144. That by mortal sin man forfeits his last end for eternity. The punishment whereby a man forfeits his last end must be endless, for one is not deprived of a thing unless it be something one ought to have. Thus a kitten newly born is not said to be deprived of sight. Now, in this life, man has not a natural aptitude to obtain his last end, as we have proved above. Therefore privation of this end must be a punishment after this life. But, after this life, man is no longer able to obtain his last end. For the soul needs the body in order to obtain its end, inasmuch as through the body it acquires perfection both in knowledge and in virtue. And the soul, once separated from the body, does this not return to this state wherein it attains to perfection through the body, as those maintained who held the transmigration of souls, against whom we have argued above? The man who is punished by being deprived of his last end must needs remain punished eternally. Again, when a thing is deprived of that for which it has a natural aptitude, it cannot be repaired unless it return to pre-existing matter, so as to be generated anew, as when an animal loses its sight or another sense. But it is impossible for a thing that is already generated to be generated again, unless it first be corrupted, and then from the same matter it will be possible for another to be generated in its entirety, the same, not identically but in kind. Now, a spiritual being, such as the soul or an angel, cannot return to pre-existing matter, so that another be generated anew, the same as before in kind. Consequently, if it be deprived of that for which it has a natural aptitude, it must needs remain eternally thus deprived. Now, in the nature of the soul and of an angel there is the order to the last end, namely God. Therefore if it be punished by privation of that order, such punishment will remain forever. Besides, natural equity would seem to demand that everyone be deprived of that good against which he has acted, since thereby he renders himself unworthy of that good. Hence it is that according to civil justice, he who sins against the state is altogether deprived of the society of his fellow citizens, either by being put to death, or by being condemned to exile for life. Nor is any account taken of the time taken in sinning, but of that against which he sinned. Now, the same comparison stands between the whole of the present life and the earthly state, as between the whole of eternity and the society of the blessed who, as we showed above, possess their last end eternally. Therefore he that sins against his last end, and against charity, which is the bond of the society of the blessed, and of those who are tending to beatitude, ought to be punished eternally, although his sins may have occupied but a short time. Moreover, in the divine judgment the will counts for the deed. As man seeketh the things that appear, so the Lord beholdeth the heart. Now, a man, who for the sake of a temporal good, has turned away from his last end, the possession of which is eternal, has preferred the enjoyment of that temporal good to the eternal fruition of his last end, so that evidently much more would he have preferred to enjoy that temporal good eternally. Therefore, in the divine judgment, he should be punished as though he had sinned eternally. Now, there can be no doubt that for an eternal sin an eternal punishment is due. Therefore eternal punishment is due to the man who turns away from his last end. Further, for the same just reason punishment is rendered for sins, and reward for good deeds. Now, beatitude is the reward of virtue. Beatitude is everlasting, as we have shown. Therefore the punishment also whereby one is deprived of beatitude should be everlasting. Hence it is said, "These shall go into everlasting punishment, but the just, into life everlasting. Hereby we refute the error of those who assert that the punishment of the wicked will at length have an end. This statement seems to have originated in the opinion of certain philosophers, who maintain that all punishment is remedial, and therefore terminable at some time. There seem to be reasons for this assertion, both because it is customary among men that punishments be inflicted by men's laws for the correction of vice, so that they are like medicine, and for the reason that if the punisher inflicts punishment, not for a further purpose but for its own sake, it follows that he delights in punishing for its own sake, which is inconsistent with the divine goodness. Therefore punishments must be inflicted for a further purpose, and no end seems more fitting than the correction of vice. Consequently it would seem reasonably stated that all punishments are remedial, and therefore terminable at some time, since what can be remedied is accidental to the creature, and is removable without the substance being destroyed. It must be granted that God inflicts punishments, not for his own sake, as though he took pleasure in them, but for the sake of something else, namely on account of the order that must be imposed on creatures, in which order the good of the universe consists. Now, the order of things demands that all things be dispensed by God proportionally, for which reason it is said that God does all things in weight, number and measure. And, as rewards correspond proportionally to acts of virtue, so do punishments to sins, and to some sins eternal punishment is proportionate, as we have proved. Therefore for certain sins God inflicts eternal punishment, that in things there may be maintained the right order which shows forth his wisdom. Even if we were to grant that all punishments are intended for the amendment of morals, and for no further purpose, we would not, for that reason, have to assert that all punishments are remedial and terminable. For even according to human laws, some are punished with death, for the amendment, not of themselves, but of others. Hence it is said, the wicked man being scourged, the fool shall be wiser. Again, according to human laws, some are banished from the state into perpetual exile, that by being rid of them the state may be purified. Wherefore it is said, cast out the scoffer, and contention will go out with him, and quarrels and reproaches shall cease. Consequently, even if punishments be inflicted only for the amendment of morals, nothing forbids certain men being, according to the divine judgment, separated forever from the fellowship of good men, and being punished eternally, so that men, for fear of eternal punishment, may refrain from sin, and the society of the good may be purified through being purged of their presence. Thus it is said, there shall not enter into it, namely the heavenly Jerusalem, whereby is designated the society of good men, anything defiled, or that worketh abomination, or maketh a lie.